Israelsin.com.
Start our third session with, of course, today with an in-depth look into the sources that that I gave you last week. The second pack, the one that is called "Finger on the Nation's Moral Pulse." No, we looked at "In Your Face" last week. Now we have the second one. And today we are going to discuss now we're going to get in depth into the makings of the prophetic experience in the Jewish foundational writings. And what I mean the makings, I mean we'll try to chart some sort of a conceptual skeleton that arguably repeats itself over and over again in the prophetic writings. And try to kind of unpack the structure which gives rise to those writings and to their rationale, to the rationale behind them. As we always do, context is a do. And here I want to say something which I remember distinctly mentioning on a previous lecture, so not to everybody here, but about a year ago with many of you, and that is the need to understand monotheism in its classical sense as the theological assertion that God or divinity is a moral necessity, and not only a moral necessity, but also a moral absolute. Now let me explain what I mean when I say a moral absolute. A moral absolute understands the divine as the source of ethics, the source of the moral code by which humans should behave, and as such, as a source which cannot be refuted or argued with by humanity. In other words, there is right and there is wrong, and the source to establish that right or wrong is not at the hands of mankind. I want to explain this because this is truly fundamental. Yeah.
So what's the meaning of the line over Shemayim?
That's a very, very different thing, which we need to contextualize on a different on a different lecture. Actually, I think we have touched Lo Bashamayim on previous notions, but right now I want to start with a theological assumption. And you remember that already from our first lecture. God created the world for a reason. The skeleton of that reason is ethical, and God is the source of that creation. Therefore, God is the source of that ethical formula. Now, I want you to understand what that means, because this notion, albeit ancient, has actually risen to surface again in its most, arguably in its most glorious form, much, much later in human history, in a document that all of you know. And it's called the Declaration of Independence of the 13 Colonies of the United States of America. Where there, and I won't get into a lecture about that, but it's a fascinating document in and of itself. We take these rights, or we take these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, blah, 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 by their creator with a capital C in the origin. And then terms like nature's God or God's nature, right? In other words, and I won't go into that, but I just want you to understand, the founding fathers of the nascent United States of America, or those colonies, understood right from the get-go, and that's where their genius truly lies, in my opinion, that if you want to establish a moral conduct for a new nation, I'm not talking now about the political ramifications, about the need to separate from the monarchy and blah, blah, blah. I don't care about that. I'm not talking yet about the influence of the French Revolution on the document. I'm talking only conceptually. If you want to establish a moral skeleton that will outlive the transient nature of fashion and human conduct, you have to put it in the hands of a source that transcends human fashion and human conduct. Let me say it in more simpler terms. If you want to establish a right and a wrong that is absolute, you have to put it in the hands of an absolute source. I'll put it in even simpler terms. If you want to establish an absolute authority, in this case ethical, you have to put it in the hands of an absolute author. Therefore, we hold these truths to be self-evident, not based on human agreement, but rather based on divine endowment, with certain unalienable rights. Lest one day someone will rise and say, you know what? And I'm going to be blunt, so pardon those who are listening to me on the internet. I don't give a shit about your moral behavior or moral code. I decide that not all men are created equal. And by the way, guess what? It happened. And I decide that what's right and what's wrong is based on the one who has the power to decide what's right and what's wrong. In other words, if morality, this is the assumption here, if morality is vested in the hand of mankind, what are you doing with your hand? It is fragile. It is a fashion. It is the result of human conflict, and it will never establish itself as a necessity that is immune to the transient fashion of human conduct and human nature. If I want to tell you that something is right or something is wrong by essence, that human life is sanctified by essence, it cannot be because you and I agreed on it. It has to be because you and I are a product or the manifestation of a higher moral authority. The ramifications of what I said right now, my friends, are profound. And I'm going to take it right to the extreme. First of all, it is quite fascinating, with all the voices that speak today in the modern world against religion and against theology and against the religion, religious discourse being the mother of all sins, quote unquote. In many cases, they're not wrong. But it's quite fascinating to look at human history and see that in the modern era, the two societies that have brought more devastation to humanity than all others combined were godless societies. Fascism and communism. And I'm not saying that they're all bad. All I'm saying is that when you look at a human construction that does not accept an absolute ethical authority, you find eventually that the authority of ethics and moral is vested in the hands of the one who has the power to enforce it. If you look at it from this vantage point, and the Nazi regime comes, and for whatever reasons, and I can give a lecture for, again, we can have a whole course about that, comes and says, based on our analysis of the nature or the natural wisdom, based on our analysis of what will be later called social Darwinism, based on our analysis of the survival of the fittest, based on all of that, we decide that we align ourselves with natural wisdom, and therefore the stronger rules and the weaker is abolished, eradicated. You cannot come to me and say that my desire to eradicate those whom I consider weak, for whatever purpose, for whatever reason, is wrong. Because based on my philosophy and my worldview, I am not deviating from the natural course of events. As a matter of fact, and you're welcome to study this more in depth, the Nazi regime believed profoundly that it is merely expediting that which nature will eventually commit to by its own wisdom or by its own inertia. We're just making it happen faster. We're helping the world to rid itself of those weaker elements. If you come and say now to someone like that, but you are morally wrong, what you're doing is wrong, that person can look you in the face and ask a very simple question. Says who? If you say, says I, then he can look at you and say, guess what? I'm sure that the gazelle doesn't like the lioness biting on its neck. But that's natural selection for you. You don't watch TV and say, bad lioness, bad lioness. All you say is, that's the course of action. That's the way nature works. We're doing exactly the same thing. Why are you inserting morality into this? This is natural wisdom. This is the natural source. Unless you come and say, no, what you're doing is wrong because there's a moral code that transcends you and me. It will always be wrong. It will always be wrong. Then you have a case. I'll just finish that. I'm not ignoring you. I'll just finish that line of thought. It is based on that notion that the founding fathers of those colonies also came and said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. They have an existential vindication. What we are about to write to you right now is not an invention of humanity, but rather a discovery of an absolute truth that awaited thousands of years to be discovered and articulated. Men were always created equal from that point of view. It is just that we came to that point of history that we finally tapped into that divine wisdom. Now, mind you, everything I just said has nothing to do with religion. I didn't say anything about religion. And I urge you to study the founding fathers and find that many of them made a very, very clear distinction between such a statement, divinity or the idea of God as the moral, supreme, absolute governor, and religious freedom. And religious freedom. It's only those who bring into that, that bring God or limit God to religious terminologies that take things completely out of context. In God we trust, for example, is not, I repeat, is not a religious statement. It's an ethical statement. I'll even say more than that. It is precisely because all men are created equal in the image of God, and all men are created with free will, because they were created equal in the image of God, that they have the free will to decide what kind of religious life they want to live, if at all they want to abide by any certain dogmatic religion. Not only is it not contradictory, it actually affirms one another. Religion of church and state does not equal, a separation of church and state does not equal separation of God and mankind. Two different things. This concept is already infused within the Jewish foundational writings. And I mentioned it very briefly last week when we discussed the so-called Ten Commandments, when I said to you, the first is not a commandment. Anochi Adonai Elohecha. It is an introduction of the absolute source. If you don't accept this as an absolute source, if you don't accept God as the absolute author of the ethical backbone which informs the theological charge, don't bother reading further. Thou shalt not murder is not a matter of fashion. Thou shalt not commit adultery is not a matter of today you can, but Wednesdays, Fridays, try not to. Honor your father and your mother is an absolute commandment, because the author is absolute. The reason I want you to understand this is because one of the most excruciating challenges that the prophet stands, as we shall see today, is the negotiation between the absolute authorship of the divine and the transient nature of human conduct. Men want to know, what is it for me now? Right now, if I steal, I'll be richer right now. If I go with this man or with this woman, I'll enjoy myself better than with my wife or husband right now. I'll deal with it later. We are incredible in rationalizing our transgressions. We are beautifully creative in cushioning the thorny edges of our chataim. We're good at that. The Navi, the prophet, wants to remind you that there's nothing fashionable about it. There's nothing here that is negotiable. Morality is absolute. Its authority is absolute. Because its author is absolute. That's why you'll see that so many prophets also condemn idolatry. It's not merely for the reason of believing one God versus believing in many gods. It's because you'll see that in polytheistic structures, there is also an ethical combat between divinities. One pushes one way, another one pushes another way. There is a lack of clarity on what humans should do. Here, there is a statement that wants to say, it's not merely about putting a wooden statue on your table. It's by understanding that the fact that there is one God means that there is only one moral code. It is a profound, it is difficult, and it is a hard to swallow theology. Because humans by nature need to deal with the versatility, the turmoils, the changing realities of their lives. And they need to face the multiple temptations which they face on a daily basis. This is what I told you last week when I said the prophet is a voice that tries to reintroduce that moment where the absolute, the divine, punctured the heavens and infused itself into the transitory at Mount Sinai. It is profoundly and perpetually difficult a task. Was this clear? Yes, dear. I'm sorry that I kept you waiting so long.
Okay. I'm trying to understand the connection between morality and the Jewish religion in terms of the writing. Where does morality come in?
Hold on, I'll show you right now.
Whole thing about, where does it say anywhere that all men are created equal in the Bible? And if that's the case, then how come there are so many rabbis who find other way, who don't, you know, who come out and say things that, and they're going according to the writings, but things that are patently racist?
Without going too much into that subject, because you're opening a Pandora case here. I told you once, Judaism doesn't talk. Jews do. That's a different thing. But Judaism doesn't talk. If somebody comes and tells you Judaism says, the rest of his sentence is either ignorant, a lie, or some sort of trying to sell you something. Judaism doesn't say anything. Jews do. Now, there hasn't yet been a Jew, as far as I know, who has a monopoly over the Jewish statement or statements. You can argue with rabbis, you can argue with scholars, you can argue with me, you can argue with any other Jew on the face of this planet about the validity of your interpretation of the divine will. I'll tell you even more than that. The beauty of the Torah and the beauty of the prophetic writings, in my opinion, lies precisely in their ambiguity. So many people misunderstand the concept of Torah, in my opinion, in my humble opinion. That's also, I'm a Jew that speaks. I'm not talking on Judaism. I say that, a Jew. Let's put things in context here. It's only me. So many people seek in Torah the answer with a capital A. And in my opinion, and by the way, I'm here echoing the voice of a much greater thinker than myself, Martin Buber, in his book Moses. You should read it. It's a small book, great book. Moses. It's called Moses. He says, the aim of Torah is not to give you the ultimate answer as much as it is to point a finger. Point a finger meaning aiming a direction. Torah, from the word more, pointing. To give you a certain direction. To give you a certain trajectory. I would venture to take this even further and say that a true Torah study aims to sharpen the intellectual faculties of human, to sharpen their ethical properties, not by giving them answers, but rather by sharpening their skills to articulate the important questions in life. I'll say it in a different way. If you and I open a Torah today, I'm sure you'll agree with me, we'll open the same book, right? Right? It's the same book. If I ask you, what does the first verse in the book of Genesis say? What would you say? The first verse in the Torah. Okay, whatever. Elohim. Well, in this case it says Elohim, you're right. Anybody argues?
No.
Good. Now, all of us agree about the statement. We don't necessarily agree about the meaning. Now, the disparity between statement and meaning is precisely the playground of human interpretation and human vitality in Jewish life. It is the ambiguity that is a perpetual invitation to become dangerously involved in the life of God. I'm quoting Heschel here. Because if it was just a blueprint, my dear, come and do this and this and this, you could immediately, and you'll be vindicated by asking, then why the hell, no pun intended, did you give me a mind to begin with? The ambiguity of Torah suggests that the human is invited to interpret it. This does not, I repeat, contradict what I believe is a fact. And that is than the theological structure in Jewish life. No matter how vast the interpretation is, no one argues with the validity of the divine author, with the validity of the divine author to construct an authoritative ethical skeleton. Are you with me? And you'll see right now, 20 examples, 30 examples, that talk, all of them talk about morality. Let me put it very plainly to you, my friends. 100% of what bothers all the prophets is moral behavior. Nothing else bothers them. Nothing else. Just ethical conduct. It's not Shabbat per se. It's what you do or don't do on Shabbat which prevents you to understand your potential as a human. It's not how much money you give or don't give. You'll see. It's the fact that you oppress the poor. Now, we talked here about the land, right? You reminded me. We talked here about the land of Israel as being as seen as a covenantal landscape. This covenantal skeleton is all abiding and it's all around you as a Jew. It is the God of Israel who commands. It is the land of Israel that harbors the subsoil for you to fulfill. And it is your soul that, according to this theological construction, was created in the image of God that gives you all the potential to fulfill the divine charge. The Talmud says, "En HaKadosh Baruch Hu makish al kankanim shenishbarim." God does not knock on a vessel if he knows that it will break. You are not given any challenge that is not within your power to fulfill. That's why Judaism in general, and here I say Judaism, never takes a human being in the entire biblical writings and elevates him or her beyond their human standard.
But it is true that some have read the prophets to mean that they don't care about Shabbat or Pulchan or ritual. Now, not in the sense that you can do what you want, but what bothered them, Zohar put it one way, I would say what bothered them was that people believe that if they behave in a ritually correct way, then it didn't matter what they did morally. That you could that you could bring sacrifices. You know, Isaiah asks on Yom Kippurim, "Is this the fast that I asked for? That you would fast, and then the next day you would exploit the poor, the disadvantaged." So that's what bothered me.
Here, if you already said that, if you already said that, turn the page to page 6. Turn the pack to page 6. Let's look. This is an example from Isaiah chapter 1. It's just the title. Isaiah chapter 1 is at the bottom of page 5. You see it starting on verse 10? Here is precisely what was said now. "Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the law of God, you people of Gomorrah." Look at this. "To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me, says the Lord? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. And I delight not in the blood of bullocks or the lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me..." Do you remember when we talked last week about if you appear before the Lord, what does it mean in the covenantal language? If you come to see the Lord, you are already, by seeing God, you are being seen. You remember that? All right? You remember that, right? "When you come to appear before me," which we already hear as, "I see you by doing this, who has required this at your hand to trample my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. It is an offering of abomination unto me. New moon and Sabbath, the holding of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity along with the solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed season, my soul hates. They are a burden unto me. I am weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Ye, when you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Here's an exact example of what was said here. Here I want to remind you to take everything you just said, which is something, by the way, we face today in the modern era. In many ways, one can see that the human nature hasn't changed dramatically. What do we do in a society, the prophet asks? What do we do in a society when the triumph of ritual over meaning screams all over the land? The triumph of ritual over meaning. Do you think that by behaving in such a way and then going to the temple and offering, you're fooling anyone? Well, yes, you are, on the horizontal level of the social discourse. The Kohen sees you bringing the offering. The people say, wow, look at this guy, he's bringing doves, he's bringing bulls, he's going, he's coming 3 times a year, blah, 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 blah. You are not behaving according to the divine charge. That's the beauty. The Kohen is not fooled, the Navi is not fooled by ritual. More than that, he would prefer meaning and the wrestling with meaning before ritual. Yeah.
This might be really stupid question. Can you be moral, ethical, according to all the morals and ethics that are being laid out here and not believe in God? According to
the prophets,
yes.
It's not even an option. So the question from a prophetic standpoint is irrelevant. You can ask me in the modern era or the postmodern era. Remember, my dear, that's why I told you in the first lecture, the Torah and the prophetic writings are a theological document. The theological document accepts the existence of God and accepts that God created the world for a purpose, which is another, which everything I told you for an hour and a half in the first. So that's, if you ask this from a prophet, he would not understand what you're saying. Just like a medieval Jew would not understand the term secular Jew. Just as he won't understand, by the way, the term religious Jew. That will be redundant. Okay? So now, asking me. Good question. I would put before you, and we have conversations with atheists and they say, I don't believe in God. Say, okay. I would venture to say, without even knowing what you mean by that statement, that I also don't believe in the God that you don't believe in. Most likely. Now, if you want an intelligent discussion about that God in whom you don't believe, let's start a discussion which can take us a whole year. On a more concrete level, I would say that to an atheist, and I say it with all due respect, there is a great question here that lies before him or her. If you don't believe in God, and here I'm talking about God not as a religious idea, because so many people are tainted with that concept of God being a religious concept, and that's not what I'm talking about. Not what I'm talking about. If you do not accept a divinity, whatever it is, as a moral author, you have a major problem, in my opinion, establishing a moral skeleton with which you can live, not as an individual, because as an individual you can live happily, but as a nation, as a community, as a people. Because you don't have the raison d'être, or you don't have any kind of grounds to argue with someone who might be very different in their moral understanding of what is right and what is wrong. That's the danger, or at least a profound challenge. And we'll stop at that because the question of atheism is very big here.
Doesn't the prophet go beyond the demands of the Torah in demanding that morality be the primary goal rather than ritual? Does not the Torah allow us to, or command of us, to act out the ritual, not necessarily for moral reasons, but because it commands it?
Where? Where does it say something like that? Show me one place.
Every mitzvah is not based in necessarily moral.
Show me. I'm
Yom HaShabbat LaKodesho.
Mm-hmm. We'll see in a minute. We'll see in a minute. You know what? I'll give you an example. Let's take a classical example also of thou shalt not cook a kid in its mother's milk, which brought rabbis eventually to say separation, complete separation. Now, here is an example. Do you think that thou shalt not cook a kid in its mother's milk talks about, and I'm about not eating a cheeseburger?
No.
What does it talk about?
It talks about the moral issue of
what?
Humaneness to animals.
About what?
Humaneness to animals.
How?
I can cook a kid. Nobody tells me I cannot cook
so
a kid.
Cruel as to kid, cook a kid in its own mother's milk.
It doesn't know.
No.
It doesn't know. The cow doesn't know.
It's an anti-pagan polemic.
No, that's true. But what she said, when you're doing it, don't be so cruel. If you're taking
cruel by whose standards? The cows?
Purely having a respect for the living of the mother and the kid.
No problem. I'll take the cow, I'll cushion it, I'll give it all the respect, then I'll take the kid, give it 3 months to live with the best food, then I'll kill it and cook it in its mother's milk. Respectfully.
But it raises a sensitivity.
About?
In a person, it causes you to think.
About what?
About all your actions and what you're doing and question why am I commanded this way? Like,
so why? I'm asking you why. Then why are you coming?
Makes you become more sensitive.
It definitely raises sensitivity. But here I want to give you one option. What is the mother's milk, what is the association between a mother's milk and its kid?
Life.
Yafeh. Life. If you take the mother's milk, which is the concept of which is giving life to the kid, and you're using it, it's the property of the kid's death and all only that, cooking it, blah, 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 blah. You're taking something which within the natural wisdom, which is accepted here as part of the divine wisdom, and in a very cynical way, you're using it against its own natural cause. You haven't done anything wrong to the kid.
It's a drush, not a pshat.
Ah, now, how do we find these things? That's exactly, you asked me, what's the role of mankind in this case? That's exactly it. I'm not saying that what I'm saying is in God's mind. That's by the way.
My question is, what is the Torah demanding of us when it makes that demand?
Let's see, guys.
It's demanding simply not to do it. Or shatnez, or korbanos.
Guys, the Torah says to you, for example, that God is one. It says so, right? No one argues with that. But what does it mean, God is one? What does it mean? That's what I said to you guys, the difference or the disparity between statement and meaning. Nobody argues about the statement, but the statement by its own definition is ambiguous. What you just said is precisely that point of Jewish life. It's a drush. Guys, look at Leviticus chapter 1. In Leviticus chapter 1, it comes and says, "Be'ever ha'yarden, be'arei Moav, ho'el Moshe ba'er et ha'Torah." After he received Torah, the first thing Moshe does is ba'er et ha'Torah. Can anybody translate? Ma ze ba'er?
Explain.
Explicate. Interpret. Moses says to the people of Israel, if there is something between you that you're not sure about, go to the Zkenim and they will interpret the law before you. Nice. If the law is so clear, why do you need interpretation? I want you to understand this concept The ambiguity of Torah calls for midrash, just like it called earlier for prophetic intervention. The prophet doesn't come to tell you what the Torah means. It comes to remind you the moral charge that the Torah puts before you. More than that, it doesn't come, if Torah was supposed to give you an answer, you and I, all we'll be doing is to study the answer from the Torah, and that will be the end of it. There will be no need to study Mishnah, there will be no need to study Talmud, and there will be no need for the Talmud, or more precisely the Talmuds, there are two of them, to put in writing the minority report of the rabbis who did not agree with the ruling of the majority. Why? Because the minority report also counts. The ambiguity of Torah sets in motion human vitality. Human vitality. The prophet comes to remind you that you have deviated. And we'll see. I want you to see this. I want you to see the structure and to try to give you the tools to raise your awareness to that deviation. He cannot or she cannot force you to repent. He or she should not force you. They cannot and they should not force you to repent. They should say it. They should be clear about it. Otherwise, they will be punished. And we'll see this. We'll see this. And by the way, I will also show you an example, perhaps next week, of one prophet that argues with an earlier prophet. Because he believes that the prophet did not understand the moral charge accurately. So let's start from the beginning. Let's go to page number 2. And let's read the two parts of the book of Exodus from the Torah and see what we can find here about the first element of our, the first brick in this edifice. And it came to pass, this is from Exodus 2, verse 23. And it came to pass in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the children of Israel, and God took cognizance of them. This is from Exodus 2. Now Exodus 34, verse 10. And God said, behold, I make a covenant. Before all your people I will do marvels, such as have not been wrought in all the earth, nor in any nation. And all the people among which you are shall see the work of the Lord that I am about to do with you, that it is tremendous. Observe you that that which I am commanding you this day. Behold, I am driving out before you the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Two elements that appear in those two excerpts. What are they? The covenant is one, and then within the covenantal paradigm that we've already discussed, two elements. I'll give you a clue, but in terms of the covenantal pledge, the covenant between the people of Israel and God, what do we see here happening? What is the difference? You know, in the Friday night prayers, we say, Shamor v'zachor bedibur echad, yishmianu elo meyuchad. Right? Shamor v'zachor bedibur echad. You remember that? What is Shamor? Observe, safeguard. What is Zachor?
Remember.
Memory and commemoration. Let me explain. The term memory or Zachor is essential not only to the entire Bible, but especially to the prophetic writings. Because without memory, you lack context. Remember that you are part of a chain. Remember that you are part of a covenant that was made with your forefathers and foremothers. Remember just as God remembers. You remember what I told you last week about the nature of the covenantal paradigm? It is absolute, albeit its realization is contingent upon human behavior. Human behavior now is commemoration. It is not enough to remember. Look at verse 11 of Exodus 34. Observe you that which I am commanding you this day. In other words, memory alone is not enough. You cannot merely remember a covenant. You have to commemorate it. You have to translate it, what I told you in the first lecture, into modalities of daily living, which becomes the impetus for what we called later religion. Memory can exist quite comfortably on the theological realm. Commemoration is a different story, because commemoration works on two levels simultaneously, always in the Jewish construction. One is on an individual basis, remember, and second, communal, national basis. Your commemoration has to be linked to the communal life of which you are part. You're not remembering alone. You don't say Shema or Zohar, say Shema Israel. All right? So the two first elements are memory and commemoration. Hence, Pirkei Avot, for example, says, "Mi shema'asav merubim michochmato, chochmato mitkayemet." He or she whose actions surpass his or her deeds, I'm sorry, actions surpass his or her thoughts or wisdom, fulfill their wisdom. It is not enough to be wise. Live. That's why the Talmud also says always, Ta Shma, come hither and learn. And then, Tse Ulmad. Now go forth and learn. And learn here is not sit in another classroom or go to another yeshiva, but rather translate what you've heard into modalities of life. Live by this wisdom. So this is the first edifice. Now I want to take you to a very, very powerful example of this idea of memory and the divine memory. In other words, God never asks of human something that God doesn't ask of itself. And one of the most powerful examples of that is the chapter of Ezekiel 16, which I've chopped here for your... And we'll start with the first 13 or 14 verses on page 3. It is a very, very powerful chapter, very graphic. And let's see what God says to the people of Israel. Who would like to read? Because I don't want to lose my... Who has a strong voice? Don't be shy, guys. Go ahead. Oh, I thought you...
Oh, I'll do it, sure.
Go ahead.
Thus says the Lord God unto Jerusalem, your origin and your nativity are of the land of the Canaanite. The Amorite was your father, and your mother was a Hittite. And as for your nativity, in the day that you were born, your navel was not cut, neither were you washed in water for cleansing. You were not salted at all, nor swaddled at all. No eye pitied you to do any of these unto you, to have compassion upon you. But you were cast out in the open field in the loathsomeness of your person in that day that you were born.
What does he say until now, Ezekiel? In so many words, you were a pitiful bunch.
You're on your own.
You were alone like an infant. Nobody took care of you. You could be killed, you could be maimed, you could be taken advantage of. Nobody took cognizance of you. Now let's see what he does.
And when I passed by you and saw you wallowing in your blood, I said unto you, in your blood live.
Bedamai chayi.
I said unto you, in your blood live.
That's the famous Bedamai chayi, Bedamai chayi.
What does that mean?
Which in your blood live.
Bedamai chayi became also a byword of the early Zionist movement after the establishment of Israel, which was the struggle for this country. People gave so much blood, and I call it the Bedamai chayi, Bedamai chayi. You shall live out of this blood. From the blood of your existence, I took you up. This is the context of what Ezekiel is saying here. It's a very powerful.
Yeah, this is central in the Brit Milah. We, when the the blood is touched to the baby's, the wine is touched to the baby's lips, we say the Damaya faith.
Now look what God says to this infant.
I caused you to increase even as the growth of the field, and you did increase and grow up, and you came to excellent beauty. Your breasts were fashioned, and your hair was grown, yet you were naked and bare. Now when I passed by you and looked upon you, and behold, your time was the time of love. I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. Yea, I swore unto you and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord God, and you became mine. Then I washed you with water. I cleansed away your blood from you, and I anointed you with oil. I clothed you also with richly woven work, and shod you with sealskin. And I wound fine linen about your head and covered you with silk. I decked you also with ornaments, and I put bracelets upon your hands and a chain on your neck. And I put a ring upon your nose and earrings in your ears and a beautiful crown upon your head. Thus was you, thus were you decked with gold and silver, and your raiment was of fine linen and silk and richly woven work. You did eat fine flour and honey and oil, and you did wax exceeding beautiful. And you was meat for royal estate. And your renown went forth among the nations for your beauty, for it was perfect. Through my splendor which I had put upon you, says the Lord God.
Okay. Talking about Jewish guilt. You're alive because of our covenant. And not only are you alive because of our covenant, I took you from Bira Amikta Le'igra Rama. I took you from the bottom of the pit, and I brought you up to become a queen among the nations. Now this is of course an allegory. And the allegory here aims to show the depth of commitment of the covenantal pledge by God. Now I want you to see here what we're doing. Look at this. Below it says, note that we now skip some 45 verses. We'll go back to them later, of prophetic chastisement. On verse 60, we jump from verse 14 now to verse 60. Between verses 15 and 60, now God reminds the people of Israel how they have repaid his covenantal kindness. However, look what God says here at the end of that chastisement, which we're going to read later. Can you continue, please?
Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish unto you an everlasting covenant. And I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall know that I am the Lord.
Okay. So what is God saying in this excerpt, in both of them, in both excerpts here? What can we learn? We're the people of Israel. What are we learning through the prophet about God's relationship, and we said relationship here, quote unquote, with us?
Constant.
Hmm?
It's constant.
It's constant, it's permanent.
No matter what.
Ah, it's unnegotiable. It's unnegotiable. Now you can come and say, wait a second, if it's unnegotiable, then I could sit like a couch potato and continue sinning for the rest of my life, and I enjoy both worlds.
Except this is post-exilic. I mean, this is after the Churban.
This is after the Churban. Yeah.
Okay, so the prophet's role here is to lift up a people that has been shattered, that has been virtually broken and destroyed. And he says to them, don't worry. The covenant is eternal. God has not forgotten, even though we've suffered.
Ah. But as he gives them now reason to come and say, okay, so we can relax and check out what is best for us. What is the purpose of this prophecy? You're right by saying, and we said it before, that the prophetic writing will always be divided in two. There is the diagnosis, right? It's diagnostic, and then it's remedial. There's always a way to better your situation.
We're missing the remedial here.
Not yet. Wait.
We're missing it. I mean, that's what's in the middle, right?
What's in the middle is a different story. We'll see in a minute. What do we have here? You already mentioned it. The covenant is eternal. However, it comes with a very heavy charge. Its realization always depends on mankind and not on God. I want you to understand this, because God, allegedly, is all-powerful. But God's omnipotence, in that sense, is withheld in order to allow humanity, exactly, to make the choice and fulfill its potential in the covenant. I'm waiting for you to do the right thing.
I don't say that.
Why? Oh, wait. Don't rush. Wait. Ezekiel is a long book, and there are many other prophets as well. Let's now jump. Ooh, it's 7:30 now. Let's now jump to page 4. After we talked about memory and the need for commemoration, now comes the second part, which is human accountability and covenantal deviation. Now let's see what God says here, what the book of Exodus says here to the people of Israel. Who would like to read? Let's have someone else. No, guys. Exodus 34, verse 12. Take heed.
Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest they be for a snare in the midst of you. But you shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars, and you shall cut down their asherim. For you shall bow down to no other god, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land and go astray after their gods and do sacrifice unto their gods, and they call you, and you eat of their sacrifice, and you take of their daughters unto your sons, and their daughters and their daughters go astray after their gods, and make your sons go astray after their gods.
Okay. What is the warning here? It's
and don't go after other gods.
Why don't go after other gods? And the covenant with me is what? What happens with those other gods? And by the way, if you look at the prophetic writings, the people of Israel went after gods all the time. All the time.
Otherwise,
there will be many less prophets if the people of Israel were actually listening to the first one. Yeah. Don't go after other gods is, again, it's focus on the ethical authority of the one God that talks to you here. Don't be confused with the humdrum of so many other deities. And I think I talked to you here last year about the fact that at early stages, there was still a recognition that there are other gods. It is just that the God of Israel is better. This classical monotheism I remember talking about will come later, actually as a post-exilic theological development. But at this point, the idea of idolatry, so don't do this, because I want you to focus. Lo yelecha Elohim acherim al panai. If we talked about face to face, there shall be no other God but me or over my face, if you want the literal translation of the verse in Hebrew. Focus on me, because from me you will hear the exact or the more precise moral skeleton. Well, my dear, go to Esther, one of the greatest heroines. She married it in many examples. Again, this is what's so rich, problematic, and challenging about the Jewish foundational writings.
Is there a recognition of other gods by God when he says, don't take other gods?
It's a completely different lecture.
God is one.
Well, God is one, but again, we have to understand that unity in context. We can show that In antiquity, there was a recognition of other deities that existed outside the boundaries of Israel. And in relation to those, the people of Israel had only one God versus many gods to other nations. It is only later, in the post-exilic era, that the one God took over other gods. And by the way, in the Jewish tradition, many of those other gods were later relegated to become angels, angelic forms, and blah, blah, blah. They became mediators between the one God. So it's a complex mechanism. So we won't go into that. But in ancient times, there was no classical monotheism as we understand it today, or understand it in the last, let's say, 1,000 years or so. Let's look at Isaiah 1 and then we'll take a break. This is Isaiah 1 and Isaiah 3. This is one of the famous Banim Gidalti Veromamti. Children I have reared and brought up. Remember Ezekiel 16? And they have rebelled against me. The ox knows his owner and the ass his master's crib. But Israel does not know. My people do not consider. Here is another statement, beautiful statement, that comes and says, the people of Israel are bound to me by a covenantal pledge. They should know better. They should know better, and yet they still rebel against me because they have the free choice. And last example, Isaiah 3. It's not such a Jewish mother. The Jewish mother came from this. And the people shall oppress one another, every man his fellow and every man his neighbor. And child shall behave insolently against the aged and the base against the honorable. Ethics or not? Completely. This is what the prophet is bothered by. Now before we move on, let's take a 5-minute break and see what we can learn more about Ezekiel 16. Let's go to page 5. And now let's explore those verses in Ezekiel 16 between the memory of God and what God had done, and then God's pledge to continue remembering and pledging itself to the covenant. Let's see how the people of Israel, according to Ezekiel, had responded to that divine charge. So we'd like to read Ezekiel 16, verse 15 and onward. Go ahead, my friend.
But you did trust in your beauty and play the harlot because of your renown, and did pour out your harlotries on everyone that passed by.
Listen to the language, very stark language.
And you did take off your garments, and you did make for you high places decked with divers and colors, diverse colors. And did play the harlot upon them. The like things shall not come, neither shall it be so. You did also take your fair jewels of my gold and of my silver, which I had given you, and made for you images of men, and did play the harlot with them. And you did take your richly woven garments and cover them, and did set my oil and my incense before them. My bread also which I gave you, fine flour and oil and honey, wherewith I fed you. And did even set it before them for a sweet savour. And thus it was, says the Lord God, wherever you have taken your sons and your daughters, whom you have borne unto me, and these you have sacrificed unto them to be devoured. For your harlotry is a small matter, that you have slain my children and delivered them up and setting them apart upon them.
Unto them. Powerful language. Powerful language that is based on a few bywords here, a few concepts. One, you forget where you come from. You forget the pledge. You forget the covenant. Three, you're taking those things which were given to you by me as a token of my devotion to you, my covenantal devotion to you, and you manipulated them in such a way that you now use them precisely against the things which I've told you to use them. This kind of cynical use of that thing which was given to you, right? And the language is, I gave you beauty. I wanted to make you a queen among the nation, and you decided to become, in Hebrew, zona. That's the language that Ezekiel is using here. Taznunai, chznunim, zona, all the different manifestations of the term zona, harlot, prostitute. You've given yourself to the highest bidder. You've used everything I gave you to become distinct and abide by a moral standard that is different, and you succumbed to the temptations of this world. You succumbed to the land which is around you. You succumbed to the immediate desire rather than having the ability to lift yourself and abide by the vision, which is different than the sight. You remember what I told you in our first lecture? A prophet is someone who constantly negotiates the disparity between sight and vision. And he or she wants the people of Israel to do precisely the same. You have a potential which you chose freely not to live by.
What is he referring to? What did they do after?
Oh, well, sacrificing their children.
That
I understood, but that in and of itself
is enough. No, it's not that. But he talks about whatever. He talks about harlot.
Livriut.
Worshipping up means betrayal. Betrayal. This is a metaphoric image.
The world
is talking about betrayal.
Talking about setting your oil and wine and all that in front of, I understand that other box.
Selling yourself cheap in order to find favor in the eyes of the surrounding societies around you. That's all. In other words, not allowing yourself the difficult path of being different. You're selling yourself short.
Divorce courthouses are full of these wordings around the world.
What? Divorce houses what?
Well, it's in courthouses where you have divorces. These are exact languages around the world.
Yeah, but that's talking about
in those, I think they are more literal in that sense, in divorce houses. But here we're talking about a figurative speech that is very powerful. Ezekiel is angry. He's angry. Because he comes and says, look what was given to you. Look what kind of a potential. Fully knowing, and guys, this is also part of the covenantal. We're talking about all Torah and mitzvot. We're talking about the burden of selectivity. We're talking about the burden of higher moral standards. It's not supposed to be easy. But you know what? It's supposed to be rewarding. Easy come, easy go. Here, you have to see the path which humanity goes and willingly decide that you don't want to join.
Prophet talk about all of Israel, men and women alike.
Oh yeah,
the
Kal Israel.
One sex or another.
No, the people of Israel. Usually the language is in the feminine because the metaphor is of a betrothal, a wedding between God and Knesset Israel, which is the assembly of Israel, which is usually referred to in the feminine. Here we have God and a daughter, in other we have God and a wife. In others, we have men. Knesset Israel is preferred as the men, and the bride is God. It depends. But the motif of the bride and of the groom and of the covenantal canopy, Chupat Brit, is very, very powerful also in the Midrashic literature.
Is he really saying that they sacrifice their children, or is it that he's saying that they... Because nothing else he's saying is literal. Is he saying they sacrifice children, or they allow their children to intermarry? What does he say?
Most likely both. In other words, the fact, in this case, most likely it's literal.
No, the
no. But I think that there is a point to see this also allegorically. By the way, right, the Torah, yeah. Look, via negativa, by virtue of Torah mentioning something, you definitely can see that the level of human conduct in antiquity would be something that will probably revile any modern human. But that's precisely it. Morality is a fashion unless there is a moral code that is perceived as absolute. Speaking of, by the way, Lagisha Bechalamolech, what you just mentioned, it is most likely that the term, when the Israelites arrived in Israel and took the land from the Canaanites, which would sacrifice their lead the firstborn son to Molech. They did so in certain urbanic centers, one of which was Gay Ben Hinnom at the foothills of Judea, in Jerusalem. The imagery, which is very, very much part of Christian imagery of hell, of that kind of a dark place where fire consumes flesh and blood and screams, blah, 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 was etched into Hebrew and Jewish memory in such a way that Gay Ben Hinnom ultimately became the synonymous or borrowed its name for Gehenom, which is the way we describe hell in a more abstract, because hell in it's different than the Christian
one. Can you put this into, for people who don't know, time-wise,
Ezekiel?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of it's supposed to be at the time of the Tanakh, or is it supposed to, I mean, of the Torah, or...
No. Okay. Torah ends with the death of Moses. Torah ends before the people of Israel set foot under the leadership of Joshua. I'm very, very suspicious or weary of dating the biblical narrative or pinning it within chronological times. If you ask the conventional blah, 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 they would say yes. The Exodus had taken place between 1280 and 1240. King David, the Itnachlut, the Tkufat of Itnachlut took 2 centuries. King David built Jerusalem around 1000 BCE. The first temple was built around 925 BCE, and so on and so forth. So yes, if you want to take it in such a way, 13th century is the end of Torah, beginning of the Itnachlut and the Nevi'im and so on and so forth. Ezekiel prophesizes after the first expulsion, in other words, after the destruction of the first temple, which happened in 586 BCE and before the return to Zion. So at the time...
How many years was that?
The first...
40 years in Babel?
No. Babel until today. Some Jews. I'm serious. If you want the chronology, actually I'll give you a way to remember it. The exile is 586. The official end of that exile and the return, not just the return to Zion, but the Koresh declaration and the 516, the beginning of building the second temple. And 70 is also the date for the destruction of the second temple. So we're talking about 586 to 516. Then we have the entire 5th century under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, the so-called return to Zion, which, to put things in historical context, less than 10% of people who were eligible actually made it back to Israel because they were very happy where they were. And then we have the second temple era until the destruction of the second temple. However, the second temple, which so many people glorify and talk about, was actually very short-lived. It was renovated by King Herod circa 22 BCE and lived for about 92 years, 95 years. Until that point, the second temple was a pretty small building and poor at that. And a lot of wrestling with other nations which were much bigger, much richer, and whose theologies were much more tempting. Hence, the prophetic literature. Okay, let's look at Amos, another prophet, on the same page, and then move to phase number 3. Amos 2. Thus says the Lord. This is something that the Chaim Nachman Bialik will later do a piece on. For 3 transgressions of Israel, ye for 4, I will not reverse it. Because they sell the righteous for silver, and the needy for a pair of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth, on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the humble, and the man and his father go unto the same maid to profane my holy name. What are all these actions? What are they doing? They're immoral actions, right? But now I want you to unpack this immorality. Why is it immoral? How is it against the theological understanding of the human condition? What is the human condition? From this standpoint, from the theological part, all humans were created in the image of God. You remember the term tzedakah, which I mentioned to you, is not charity. It's definitely not about giving money. This is a tool. Charity is a tool for tzedakah.
Justice.
More than yes, justice is part of it, but justice is tzedek. There's a difference why there's a reason why there is a word tzedek, which appears in the Bible, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, and tzedakah.
Moral justice.
No, I don't think that there is a justice that is not moral. Yeah. Ve'chashva lo letzedakah. Tzedakah is something more subtle, but more profound also.
Or is worthiness.
worthiness. Tzedakah is the human action that aims to bring the elements of life and the participants of life into some sort of a harmonious utility. Lift the poor so I can look him in the eyes. Humble the proud so I can look him in the eyes. Bring people onto the same level. So the social structure, literally the social structure, reminds each and every person that they are part of God above. If you're a judge, if you're a king, what does God say to Shmuel when Shmuel says to God that the people of Israel want to have a king over them? He says two things. One, I'm upset because they don't remember who is their true king. That's number one. But, however, I will listen to them and I will appoint them a king. However, that king should remember ולא ירבלו סוסים ולא ירבלו נשים ולא ירבלו. Shall not use that power that they have now to lift themselves among or lift themselves above the people. Rather, use your power to lift everyone else.
The vision or living the moment.
Exactly. In other words, do not, again, do not fall into the temptations of a transient condition. You're a king one day, you will be poor the other. You're a poor one day, you have the potential of being a king. Remember to be humble if you're rich. Remember to be proud, proud in the good sense, if you're poor. Why are God's favorite always the poor? Because they're the ones who need to be lifted. They're the ones that remind the human, the poor has a role here. He reminds you, he or she reminds you, by virtue of their existence, that you haven't yet fulfilled your potential as a human, you, by not helping them. Not with just money, it's not money. It's conducting your life in such a way that eradicates the state of poverty from the universe. That's tzedakah. That's why I mentioned to you that the land of Israel itself is required to take an active role in the act of tzedakah. Leket, peah, and shichecha are mitzvot התלויות בארץ, that have to do with tzedakah. Allow food to the poor. Don't pick it up if it fell off your tractor. If you didn't harvest it, don't touch it. Let those people benefit from the land because the land exists in covenantal relationship with divinity. This is what bothers the prophet. Now, from the covenantal paradigm, we already know. If there is a deviation, by natural effect, what will happen? We saw it last week with Panim el Panim. If you deviate, yes, by deviating, by already turning your face, by turning your face, God cannot see you anymore. Therefore, if God cannot see you, you cannot see God. So let's see what happens in divine rebuke and withdrawal. We already read, if you remember the first one, when we mentioned the idea of the triumph of ritual over memory, over meaning. And this is something incredibly powerful. We see it until today. This is, in my opinion, one of the greatest challenges that we have today in the Jewish world when it comes to institutions of Jewish education. We do a marvelous job in teaching our children what to do. We do a lousy job in teaching them why they're doing it. Each generation appoints teachers who try to move the ritual from one generation to the other without leaving their thumbprint on it. As fast as possible, give it to the next generation. Why? Because it's important for Jewish continuity. Nobody stops to ask, wait a second, why are we continuing this? Our kids know to recite the Shema by heart. They never took the time to understand the multiple meanings of the Shema in a meaningful way. They can light candles, they can read the Siddur, but they don't necessarily deal with the meaning behind it. And the prophets come and say, It is not the ritual which I seek. I first seek meaning. Kavanah. Mashma'ut. Now let's see divine rebuke. Isaiah 3. Would like to read Isaiah 3. It's a second source.
The Lord will enter into judgment with the elders of his people and the princes thereof. It is you that have eaten up the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What mean you that you crush my people and grind the face of the poor, says the Lord, the God of hosts?
Let's read the second one as well, Isaiah 5.
Woe unto them who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Woe unto them that are mighty to drink wine and men of strength to mingle strong drink, that justify the wicked for a reward and take away the righteousness of the righteous from him.
Okay. What are these two excerpts talk about? First of all, who are they talking to? It's pretty self-explanatory. Who is Isaiah talking to?
The elders.
The elders. The rich and the powerful. You can understand immediately that from within the context, within the social context of the prophet, he puts himself in harm's way. You remember I told you, the prophet, by the inner definition of prophecy or the prophetic idea, is someone that Heschel called a person that was chosen by God to be rejected by men. He's putting himself in harm's way. Why? Because one is because they're powerful.
Unpopular.
Second,
unpopular.
Why unpopular? You're right. Why unpopular?
Because supposed to stop living the minute, the here and now.
More than that. Absolutely, and more than that. What is he trying to do here? What is he trying to do to the powerful?
Expose
them and then what?
Bring them down.
So it's not just that he's talking to the power, to the powerful, to the ones that have the money, the resources, the power, the ones that can bend the arm of a judge or the judges themselves. He comes and says, "My raison d'être, the reason I'm here, is not just to expose you. If I'm successful, by definition, you will not be powerful anymore. By definition, you cannot remain powerful in that sense of the word. Obviously, there's something profoundly difficult in that clash of powers. That's why the only tool that the prophet has in his or her disposal is that they are backed by a higher moral authority. Because remember, my friends, in a context or in a world that doesn't have such a context of this absolute author, it is these people that decide what is right and what is wrong.
Speak truth to power.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. So here comes a man now that comes and says, guess what? There is a right that transcends your power. There is a right that is not chosen amidst the walls of your courtyard. There is a truth that does not abide by your bribery. And I represent it here on earth because God told me so. If this is not effective, or if this falls to ears that do not accept, that goes to your question, my dear, if this falls on ears that says who? Says God, and they say we don't believe in that God, then we have a problem. The prophecy accepts as granted that the people who hear at least accept the reality of a divine author. Whether they commit to it or not is a different question. But they accept that there is a divine author. This becomes a much, 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 much more difficult story if one does not accept a divine author. Because there, he does not accept the authority of the prophetic charge. Let's move to page 7. Here is a small prophet, Hosea, short. Hosea 4, it's the 4th source. Here Hosea says something quite interesting. Therefore you shall stumble in the day, after chastising them for what they had done, forgetting God, moving, deviating. And the prophet also shall stumble with you in the night. And I will destroy your mother, My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. I will also reject you, that you shall be no priest to me. Seeing you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. Powerful stuff. However, if you already understand the prophetic language, you should make few amendments to this statement, or at least contextualize it.
If you continue to do what you're doing, then this shall happen.
In other words, I will also forget your children is not an absolute statement. It's conditional. But how do you explain the term or the phrase, and the prophet also shall stumble with you in the night? Now that's powerful stuff. Ah, the rabbis would love what you just said. For a reason, absolutely. Why do you think he says that though? First of all, excellent point. The prophet is a part of the community. First of all, the prophet is also a human being. Second, you already started. I asked, why does Hosea here say, and the prophet also shall stumble with you in the night?
Because I'll continue to keep you in the dark, and the prophet would not shed light on where you were supposed to.
So, what do you think Hosea is responding to? To what kind of a understanding of prophecy among those people at the time? We all go down together, okay. How can a prophet be understood by certain people? Obviously, some people don't like him, but trust me that the orphan and the poor and the commoner actually like him because he's representing them in so many ways. What is God, through his prophet, telling the people here about the role of the prophet? Okay, so first of all, the prophet is part of you, okay? Second, if the prophet is not successful, he's not going to be saved either. More?
Also, people don't appoint prophets, it's only God.
Do not rely on a prophet to come to save you every time you commit a transgression. In other words, prophecy is a luxury. This is precisely what the rabbis ultimately will work on. The point of prophecy is a luxury. Prophecy is a constant reminder that God has not yet given up in that sense. It's later that rabbis will have to find another way to rekindle the eternity of the covenant through Talmud Torah rather than prophetic example. But this is a whole different lecture. Well, remember, we're talking about a covenant with the people, not just with you. It's just exactly the same question of Avot Achlu Boser V'Shinei Banim Tikena. And we'll see that discussion in Ezekiel, where he comes and says, I disagree with that concept. Every generation should pay for their own transgression rather than another generation paying for your transgressions. We'll see that. We'll see. There is an argument here. Okay. You remember when we talked about divine retribution, we divided it into parts. What was it? What were the two parts that we talked about when we talked about divine retribution? One of them was passive and the other one was active. You remember? No. When we talk about retribution, we're still now at the part of retribution. You committed, you deviated, you turned your face. I am now reacting in two ways. One of them was, you remember, suspending grace, hiding the face, you remember that? And then active judgment. I will put my face before, you remember those phrases? I will put my face on you and devour you and eat you. And in other words, by suspension of grace, divinity allows for misery to enter, for turmoil to enter, you remember that? And by active retribution, divinity actually hits and strikes, okay? I can tell you, look, you know, the beauty of this, in my opinion, the beauty of this system is that a lot of people, in my opinion, of course, everything is in my opinion, do not necessarily understand the structure or the mechanism of divine retribution in the covenantal sense of the word. Let me explain what I mean. We're not talking, if you deviate, I'm going to slap you on the hand. That's not the idea. If you're going to commit a sin, you're going to burn in hell. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about this kind of an quote-unquote infantile model. If you do this, I'll hit you. If you don't do this, I'll give you a carrot or I'll give you a stick. This is not the idea. The idea here is that the act of transgression and the way you lead your life in result of that choice is already a punishment. Now let me explain what I mean. You can live in transgression and feel, by value, very rewarded for the in the short run. You can be rich because you stole a lot of money, and you can be gratified because you cheated, and you can. This is precisely what the prophet tries to say here. He has to come and say, look, do not be fooled by the fruits of your transgressions, because those will be outlived by the moral decay that you are going to suffer. In other words, it's not if you're going to curse God, God is going to kill you right on the spot. It's much more complicated than that and much more immediate. It comes and says, living in sin is already the punishment. Just like schar mitzvah, mitzvah. In other words, you understand what I just said in Hebrew? The reward for the mitzvah is the mitzvah. By cleansing your soul, by thinking positively about a poor man or a poor woman, by taking a second to look at them, by feeling that sensation of compassion, this in and of itself is a refinement of your soul. This is the reward already. What are you looking for? What kind?
Retribution.
Hmm? The retribution, we're talking about the retribution in the covenantal sense of the word, guys. Don't forget, that's why I made a full hour lecture about the covenantal paradigm. The retribution is the actual transgression. The retribution is the transgression.
But he's saying you'll be destroyed.
You are destroyed. You are being destroyed. You are being destroyed. By living. I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. Again, without getting into, and I obviously I cannot argue it at face value. I will argue that the concept here is much, much, much deeper. And that is that you can fool everyone but yourself. And if you cannot fool yourself, you cannot fool God, because you're a part of that. In other words, that moral corruption is based on an intimate knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. You can persuade yourself that what you're doing is for your own benefit and you're enjoying it, but you know that it's wrong. I'll give you a moment. For example, we talked about murder or cheating or being disloyal. Look, in the Haggadah of Pesach, which we read, two months ago. You remember the four sons? Right, we remember the four sons. Who is the Rasha? Did you ever think about the Rasha? Evil, it's a strong word. Why is he Rasha? What? Hotzi et atzmo me'aklal. And therefore, kafar, ba'ikar. And therefore, kafar is the very essence of what it means to be part of the Jewish people. You are part of a community. Guys, in that sense, Judaism is a family name. Being Jewish is an experience that extends by definition beyond the realms of your private existence. Being Jewish is already tying yourself to something that extends larger than you in space and in time. Aravim Zelazeh is one expression of that. Zachor is another expression of that. The communal existence is part and parcel of the Jewish existence. Okay, so in that sense, again, I want you to understand, and going back to this, to the question that you asked me, dear, you have to let go of that dual or dualistic model that still governs maybe some of the minds here, that there is a cause and effect. That's not what I'm talking about. The act of transgression itself is the punishment. This is the punishment. Removing yourself from divine grace is the divine retribution. You are causing yourself to lose sight of God. Ken, but again, when you say it's not immediate, you are still chopping it into space and time. And what I'm trying to explain here is, and I know that it's a hard concept to reintroduce or to reintegrate into existing models, but the model, this old model of I'm here and God is there, I'm doing things and God is looking at me, and God is making a choice, is not what I'm talking about. And arguably, it's not what the prophets are talking about. They're coming and telling you a very profound and powerful message. They come and say that the harmonious utility, the harmonious existence of the world, relies on your behavior as part of God above. And even God cannot make you change your ways. However, God can punish you by your choice. You made a choice to punish yourself by living a life according to the way that you chose to live. That's what I'm saying. And this, I know that it's something that is hard. People say, "Ech ze sherasha vetov lo, tzadik v'ra lo." You know that great question. Tzadik v'ra lo, rasha vetov lo. And I know what I'm about to say right now, some of you may find it very difficult to swallow. But I stand by my statement here. I haven't met a Rasha Shetovlo. I haven't met such a person. No matter what they say, I haven't met one. I haven't met one. Because the moral code here is what governs your human conduct. You can fool others. You can even fool yourself sometimes. Say, well, at least I have a lot of money. But to live in fear, to live in suspicion, to hide the truth from your loved ones. You can be the richest man on earth. You can be the most powerful. I mean, and look, the world we live in, unbelievable. You see it all the time. Look at this, I don't want, allegedly, Strauss-Kahn, the French. In one second, from the top of the world, in 1 second. Now, allegedly, I'm saying because I'm being recorded here, so right now, he's not convicted. He's allegedly, if what he did is true, you want to tell me that with all the money, and with all the power, and all the support that he receives from his loving wife and family, and whoever, God bless them, inside, you tell me that Rasha V'Tovlo? Even before he was caught, Rasha V'Tovlo? Well, I don't believe that a person, by definition of being a person, can lie to themselves on that level. That I don't believe. No, that's a completely different story. That's a completely different story. The fact that you continue doing something does not mean that you don't acknowledge it as evil. That's nothing to do with that. People continue choosing evil every day. Every day. And we are masters.
Because it's
Tovlo. It's Tovlo right now. It fits the purpose of this. But morally.
Maybe you don't think it's
Tovlo. Yeah. We can argue. Yeah. I mean, again, guys, I'm telling you that's what I believe. I'm not telling you that it's absolute truth.
There are people who see this literally, that there is divine retribution.
Oh, yeah, of course.
That God punishes the people of Israel when they don't, whatever they do.
Of course, yeah. And I disagree with that view. I think that it's very immature. I think that it fits children. And I think that a much deeper, a much more thorough, a much more challenging view. No, don't even go there. Don't even go there. You're making a big mistake by generalizing such a group of people under one term. Don't do it to others. You don't want it to be done to you. There isn't such an entity called the Orthodox. Forget about that concept. There isn't such an entity of any group. Within the Orthodox, I can find you 1,000 ways of understanding this, including the way I just told you. Including the way I just told you. Mipnei chataenu galinu me'artzenu. The very idea of exile is not a divine retribution, it is our own sins that caused us to be exiled. In other words, the very approach that I just talked about. So be very careful here. There is no clear dichotomy about one model versus the other. What I'm trying to tell you here in this very brief course is that in order to understand the prophets in what I believe is a deeper level, you must first and foremost understand the gravity of the covenantal paradigm. And the covenantal paradigm doesn't create such a chasm between God and men as a way to look at God as if I'm looking at you and wait for his retribution. The very act is what causes the retribution. Wait, there was somebody who was waiting here very patiently. Yeah.
I'm just curious, if we're assuming now that good behavior is the reward in itself and bad behavior is the punishment in itself,
yeah.
That's assuming that the person that's doing that act has a certain knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
So who's responsible for good or bad behavior if that individual is ignorant, or if the community has taught them in another way?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here, that's a very, very good question. And here again, we are building this entire edifice on the theological assumption of theomorphism. That's what I mentioned to you 2 lectures ago. That the human was created in such a way that he or she knows what's right and what's wrong at its very core by being part of God above. In other words, that the ethical backbone of the human condition is not something that is acquired. What to do in order to present it is a different story. Are you allowed to drive through a red light? That's a different thing. By the way, even in modern law, yediyat hachok eina poteret meonish. In other words, not knowing the law does not does not excuse you from being punished. But that's a different story. To your question is, the belief, the fundamental belief is that the human knows that it's wrong to kill. Knows. Now, how much in your society do you skirt that knowledge? How much do you succumb to the comfort of, in order to conquer, you kill someone or you do that or you do that? It's a different story. But you know that it's wrong. You know that it's wrong to take an infant and abuse them. You know that. You don't need to live at a certain era in life, in time, to say, oh, in this society it's fine, though I'm going to do it. So the knowledge is inherent rather than acquired.
I think that that disempowers what a community is. Like how you just explained Judaism and the power of that community, that is disempowered by saying that you're completely born with it and how you choose to deal with those thoughts in whatever time you are living in. It's up to you, or it's different
more. No, I never said it's up to you. No, I didn't say it's up to you. What I said is, that religion, now we're talking about religion based on the theological chart. Religion now manipulates your entire life, both as an individual and as a community, in order to most adequately live by that knowledge. In other words, what should you do now on a daily basis in order to give rise to these values and this kind of knowledge? How should you treat a person on the street? How should you treat the trees and the vegetables and the sky? And how should you treat the environment? How should you treat your wife, your husband, your children? How should you treat your neighbor? What should you wear to remind you of your place in the world? What should you eat to remind you that you are different than others? And most of the rituals in Judaism aim precisely that, to remind you of your place before God, so you never succumb to those temptations that try to say to you, okay, today I will do that, and tomorrow I will do that. And again, I'm not talking about a particular religion. I'm talking about the need, the human need for religion. Now comes the community and says, what do we do as a community to give flesh and blood to this theological skeleton? That's where community comes. Because to do it alone, it's very, 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 very difficult. You're absolutely correct. To do it alone is very, very difficult. But I'll tell you more than that. People, for example, sometimes ask me, are you religious? And I hate that question because I think that people use the term religious in such a shallow manner and they look at your facade and oh, you're... So I immediately ask, what do you mean? So, oh, are you Shomer Torah or Mitzvot? So, well, by being human and being moral, I would say absolutely yes. Oh, so do you keep Shabbat? I say, well, by being moral and in my way, I keep Shabbat also. But do you... now you're talking about something completely different as far as I'm concerned. Because now you're looking into the lowest common denominator to tag me. And that's another human desire, to tag people, put them in... I remember hearing, I think I told you that a few days ago, I remember hearing that after the former president, Katsav, was convicted in rape, and they asked one of the jailers who was supposed to accept them before they knew that he's going to give an appeal that they were expecting. And they asked him, what are you going to do? I mean, this used to be the number one citizen in Israel. He's going to prison. How are you going to do? He said the following thing, which I remember. I jerked in my seat. He said, well, we have a problem because on the one hand, he's a convicted rapist. And on the other hand, he's a man who is Shomer Torah Mitzvot. And we have to reconcile the two. No, but you see, that's the problem. How can you say a convicted rapist and a Shomer Torah Mitzvot? Just because he has a yarmulke, is it? He's Shomer Torah Mitzvot? Now, that doesn't mean that he doesn't Shomer other elements of the Torah and the Mitzvot. Great for him. I'm not saying it facetiously. But Shomer Torah Mitzvot, and I am not because, or you are not because, again, the triumph of ritual over meaning. Let's deal with the actual thing. And what we read before is precisely that. The prophet is not sidetracked by the abundance of ritual. He looks right into you. And in so many words he says, God is not impressed by all this. So much noise, so much da-da-da-da-da-da-da. People leave Yom Kippur in the synagogue. 5 minutes later, they cheat, they lie. Unbelievable. I'm not even talking about the reason they came to the synagogue to begin with. I'm not even talking about that. I'm not talking about the fact that today we have a religion that has succumbed to spaces and times where we find our Jewishness coming to life twice a year in certain places. Why? You stop being Jewish outside the street. Your Jewishness left you, succumbed. The complexity of not taking life for granted. And then the choice of doing it as part of a community in particular manners, which distinguish us from others.
Knowing there's a Father watching us 24/7.
No. Knowing that as long as you are alive, God is alive. You're watching yourself 24/7. And you know what? What? That's what that's why you mentioned Arthur Green. And Arthur Green, really, a great theologian, he said, he has a wonderful essay that is called Speaking in Thunder. And Arthur Green, one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century and the 21st century. And he said, the only God I know, I quote, is a divinity that cannot be expressed in this world at all, except through human actions. You know why? And that goes to the covenantal paradigm, my dear. If you succumb to this kind of dualism, you're excusing yourself from the accountability and responsibility that comes with being inseparable from God. That's what monotheism charges you with. You are never a part of God. Even when you hide your face, there is still a way to return. The navel cord is never cut off. It's impossible by virtue of your existence. No, no. How can you be apart from God? It's dualism. Apart of God. Apart, you are a part, not a part, a part of God. We're talking in so many words about a panentheistic view here. We're talking about a concept that comes and says, if God is one, then God is all. And one theologian put it beautifully, we are that part of God which tries to understand all of God. We're trying to figure it out. And I come and say, and I said it before, that perpetual sense of yearning, of curiosity, the thirst to understand why on earth, pun intended, I'm here, is precisely that divine endowment which aims to put you on that journey of finding out. That's the meaning of life. Ignorance may be bliss, but up to a point. Only up to a point. Tov, chaverim, it's already 8:40, so I took time from you.